It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Welcome back, Kirk. Welcome back to myself.
Welcome back to yourself. Well, you did make a guest appearance last week.
I did. It was very brief. Yeah, and you know why? It's because I was getting ready for this big trial in Madison, and I was running around like a madman getting things done. And you so graciously covered the show and allowed me to do my final trial preparation.
And Kirk's being humble, but he just won a huge federal trial down in Madison. So I'm sure you'll read about that in the newspaper. So congrats to Kirk.
Well, thank you.
It was fantastic. Just wonderful. Corey Stingley. This is a guy who...
Oh, I heard about this.
You heard about this? He was 16 years old. Tragic situation.
Did you see the video on
this? Yes.
I did too. And boy, I don't know what to think of it.
Well, and I'll just give the backstory in this. Mr. Stingley was 16 years old. He died December 29th of 2012. He died after being restrained by three customers at a West Allis convenience store when he attempted to steal alcoholic beverages. Now, what happened essentially was that, at least according to the surveillance video that just was released this week, it shows three customers restraining Stingley after they saw him shoplifting. And he was basically, according to the reports, taking little bottles of vodka and sticking them into his backpack. Stingley was on video putting those into his backpack. He was then confronted by the clerk at this convenience store, and Stingley then reached for his debit card and sort of ran off. He was about to pay for something else, not alcoholic, but then he ran off, according to the story. Then there was a struggle with the three men, one of whom apparently put his knee on Stingley's back to restrain him. Police arrived minutes later, and Stingley had no pulse. He wasn't breathing, and he was dead, essentially, or shortly thereafter died. There was a lengthy investigation in this by the Milwaukee County DA's office and the authorities.
Took about a year,
and they actually had a John Doe hearing on this whole thing. I don't know exactly the particulars of the John Doe hearing, but suffice it to say, the DA's office chose not to charge the three customers, one of whom was represented by our good friend Tony Cotton,
mm-hmm.
Who's an excellent lawyer in the Milwaukee area.
Let's just interject in case our listeners don't know what a John Doe hearing is. We've referenced John Doe hearings at numerous points over the years on the show, but in case you're not a frequent listener, a John Doe hearing is almost an exploratory, investigative type hearing whereby a DA can enlist the aid of the court to conduct a hearing as an inquiry. And the idea is that, especially if it's a politically sensitive or close call in some things, they get guidance from the John Doe hearing and the results therefrom in terms of whether or not a charges should be issued. So they're conducted in secret, meaning that they're not open to the public, and the results of a John Doe investigation are not made public either. So we don't know, and I presume that we won't know, what exactly the results of the investigation were. It is possible that a John Doe investigation can recommend charges, and the DA can still decline to do so. So it doesn't necessarily follow that the John Doe recommended no charges. But certainly, this is a tough call. I looked at the video myself, and I understand the concept behind Chisholm's decision not to issue the charges, but it is troubling that the facts leading up to all of this were that this young man was committing, admittedly, a very petty offense, a minor shoplifting type offense. To make matters more confusing, it's my understanding that the convenience store or gas station owner had already agreed to not call the police if he returned the vodka, which he did. He agreed to do.
Yeah, there was some discussion about that.
Yeah, and it's a bit confusing as to how explicit that conversation really was, meaning how clear it really was.
Right, but regardless of that, though, he apparently ran out of the store, and they were trying to detain him. Now, albeit, yes, a petty offense, I mean, a petty theft-type situation, but the DA's office, in charging this, I give them credit because they had to find either that there was some type of intent or the actions of these three individuals or any one of them caused an unreasonable and substantial risk of great bodily harm or death. They didn't find any of that, and I don't know that there was any type of evidence to that in that regard, especially because one of them had his knee on the back. Now, certainly this is tragic and it's awful, and the father is very, very upset, understandably so, but not everything that happens in these situations is a crime.
And I'm just going to play devil's advocate here, because that's something that you and I do very well with each other. And,
yes.
You know, just to point out that it's kind of one of the features of our show is that we end up at each other's throats, whether by hook or by crook. We sort of bait each other into these arguments. So I'm going to bait you into one right now.
All right. Go ahead and bait.
Here's my point. And I would simply state that when you see what happened here, and let's say instead of a 16-year-old black child, this was a 70-year-old lady that was putting some vodka bottles into her purse. Do you think three men would wrestle her to the ground violently enough so that her chest was being compressed by the weight of three grown white men?
Well, no, I don't know. Were there three or was it just one?
It was a total of three people that were involved. Three against one in the struggle. And I understand that presumably their intent was to restrain this individual while awaiting the police, but they did it in such a way that I think it could be argued that I don't know if we can go so far as to say what was in their minds. And that's the problem with any one of these cases, especially when you're talking about a reckless or even a negligent homicide type charge. And the law does provide for prosecution of somebody that engages in criminally negligent conduct that has a foreseeable consequence of death or great bodily harm. And we also have to look at the particular characteristics of the individual. Interestingly enough, there is a split here between civil law and criminal law, because in the civil world, we have what's called the eggshell doctrine. And if you remember way back in law school, it wasn't quite as far back for you as it was for me, but I think I went to school that day and I think I took notes. But as I recall in my torts class, my professor explained that you have to, if you're a plaintiff happened to have had such a thin skull that it was the thickness of an eggshell, you have to basically take your victim as he or she is. And you should be able to foresee that some people have weaker constitutions than others.
Right. So they may be able to sue them. I mean,
civilly.
Civilly. But here's the thing that bothers me about this, Kirk. I mean, there was a group that called these three men a, quote, self-appointed, out-of-control posse that killed a black man. One that says that the father said that these men plotted to do something. I mean, that, he's talking about intent there. Plotted to kill this man, this young man. And that there's no evidence of that. And that's what bothers me about this. Well, now we're going to get everybody all riled up.
The father may not have chosen the most legally appropriate words, but what he's getting at is that the three of them had an agreement that may have been formed in milliseconds. It may have been formed instantly. And the law of conspiracy does state that an agreement can occur at a moment's notice.
That's fine, but there was no evidence. There was nothing to suggest that they were beating him or anything like that. The only evidence that I saw, at least in the video, is that they were attempting to restrain him because they saw that he was attempting to steal something from this store.
Well, let's say that these were police officers, and let's say they were attempting to restrain him, and let's say that it resulted in the death of a 16-year-old black boy.
Well, don't we have something like that happened in Milwaukee in the back of a squad car?
It absolutely did.
And there were no charges.
That caused quite a ruckus. And I think that both you and I agreed that that was probably questionable. I mean, at least in terms of what the duty of a police officer is under the circumstances. I understand it's completely different. It is very
because he was screaming for apparently for help. He was saying he was going to die.
Right.
This man, there's no evidence that that happened. And again, I'm not saying it's not tragic, Kirk, but I am saying that this reaction, that everything that happens that is tragic needs to somehow be punished.
Well, and I'm not saying I agree with that concept either, but that's the world we live in. Haven't you and I lived
pretty close to it, Kirk?
Yeah, haven't you and I just lived recently through a series of cases where prosecutors have charged mere negligence as criminal charges?
Yes.
And it sounds horrible and it seems horrible, but that's what our society demands now. And, you know, just within the past, 10 years, the federal government has implemented over several hundred new federal criminal laws that attach criminal liability to mere negligence.
Right.
This is the modern era we live in. We prosecute people for making mistakes.
Exactly. And that's why I think that the DA's office in Milwaukee County made the right decision. Now, it's weird to say they ought to be applauded because there was a young man who died, and that's tragic anytime you have this. But what I do applaud them for is making a tough decision. Chisholm knew when he made the decision, he had to know that it was going to cause a huge community backlash of support for this young man. And I understand why, because he died and there was really no good justification for him dying, especially if he was just stealing bottles of liquor. But to somehow transform that into this was some plot by three men who happened to be in a convenience store.
I think the use of the word plot was unfortunate, right? Because it suggests that it was
premeditated.
And that might be unfortunate too. But I think the point here is that by all appearances, this was an overreaction to a situation that could have been handled differently without the extent of violence. And I think that's why the community in Milwaukee is so upset over the decision. And we're not talking about a decision to, we're talking about not even putting it before a jury.
Right.
Because let's say we have cases all the time where a DA or a prosecutor in some, you know, even if it's in federal jurisdiction, they will say, you know what, we really don't know what happened here, so let's let a jury decide.
But the prosecutor in this case, Chisholm, said, I can't prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. He has an ethical obligation, I think,
And that is true, and I should point that out, that it's not simply a matter of maybe he'll get a conviction, maybe he won't. But you're correct, Casey, in the sense that there is an ethical duty on the part of a prosecutor to not proceed on a case that he personally does not believe he can prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
We'll be back and we'll talk about this Sheboygan Falls story that is all over the news in just a moment. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Oh, we usually say just our first name.
I know.
Second time around.
I'm sorry about
you're
that.
You're breaking up the routine.
I'm just getting too excited.
Throwing me off.
This story, this next story has
Sheboygan
just got me all going.
All right.
Yes, the Sheboygan Falls story. The Sheboygan Falls newspaper did a story on three basketball players at Sheboygan Falls High School, Jordan Jamal and Jawan Jackson, who apparently moved into the district fairly recently and are now playing basketball for the team. In the process of that, for the Sheboygan Falls News, the paper took two pictures. One of them was serious. They're both wearing their basketball uniforms, you know, serious picture. The other one was the boys goofing around. And in the goofing around photo, that was the one that appeared in the local newspaper. Well, that caused a huge storm and a huge ruckus because in that picture, one of the boys in the middle is sort of pointing at the camera. The other is putting up sort of three of his fingers in what he describes as a three-point sort of shot. And I've, by the way, I can back him up on this because you've seen LeBron James
do
this. You've seen
LeBron James does that when he gets 3 points.
Right.
He goes three.
Basketball players do that. Now, this caused a ruckus because the district superintendent said that a police liaison officer then brought to their attention that these hand gestures may be questionable. And what do they mean by questionable?
Gang signs, right?
Well, the district actually asked, according to WHBL News, asked the Sheboygan Falls police to investigate, which then confirmed the gestures were gang symbols. And oh my God, then you have a jumping off point. So the district, following the athletic code, suspended Jamal and Jordan. Okay, they suspended them. They wouldn't say how long due to confidentiality. They're suspended for the basketball game, or at least one of the basketball games.
At least one game, yeah.
Yeah. And the Falls police chief said the department's investigation included a meeting with the boys and their family. He said while the gestures were determined to be gang signs, the brothers adamantly denied that their action was intended to be criminal in nature. He said that the department does not see the gestures as a threat. The editor of the newspaper is just dumbfounded, according to WHBL News. And I'm so outraged by this in so many different ways, I can't even begin to tell you.
Well, they went around and asked parents of students at this school whether they were upset or if it even occurred to any of them that these might be gang symbols. And universally, the answer was no. In fact, until you mentioned it, it never even occurred to me. And, you know, this is something that, and I just have to ask the question. I'm sorry I have to ask this question, but I'm going to. These are black kids. And that I think that there was a presumption that when someone's making a hand gesture and it happens to be an African-American person, that it has a different connotation than if they were white kids.
Well, and that's a good question.
It's unfortunate, but I think that might be what is going on here.
It may be, Kirk. But the bottom line is this is a huge overreaction to this story. It's what I believe Jon Stewart calls fake outrage.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what it is.
Yeah.
And you know, you see this picture.
Well, we can't say what he really calls it, but it's
something similar
to
that.
BS Mountain.
Right, exactly. So you have these boys who are doing nothing. This is a feel-good story in the newspaper about these three young men. They're sitting there, and they're playing for the basketball team, and one of them makes a three-point symbol, and somebody's, do we really have to get the police department to investigate this? What are we investigating this for? What is the point of this investigation? What's it going to lead to? Do we have any information that these boys are involved in a gang? Why? Because they got into a picture and put up a three-point sign?
Well, maybe they should.
Come on.
Maybe an investigator that's familiar with, I don't know, basketball should probably have looked into this, you know?
Right.
I knew that about LeBron James.
Yeah. Is he being investigated for a gang activity every time he makes a three-point shot? I mean, this is just ridiculous. And it is such an overreaction. Kirk, first of all, I'm getting too worked up about this.
You're sweating.
But first of all, for the district to investigate this, okay, they might say, well, we have an athletic code. We have to investigate this. But then to follow through and suspend two of these boys for this?
In spite of the investigation, which I'm sure, well, let's face it. Part of the investigation, one half of the investigation would be to bring the kids in and the parents and talk to them and ask them what happened. The other half of the investigation is this so-called, you know, gang knowledge that comes from law enforcement sources. And, you know, I understand that officers do get training in specific areas, and some of that's important, some of it's very legitimate. But I can tell you, Casey, well, I don't have to tell you because you've seen it also in some of these cases, there is definitely a phenomenon that consists of overreaching to make more significance out of a very minor, innocuous detail so much of the time. I can't tell you how many times I've heard things that I don't know where these myths come from, you know? So wherever this supposed gang symbol that they identified without considering the possibility that what the young man was saying was actually correct, which if you look into it, it is, you know, right. It makes absolute sense. Plus, they're basketball players playing for their high school basketball team. I mean, it makes perfect sense. And it didn't, the only ruckus it caused was based on this erroneous belief that it was some sort of gang flashing symbol. But how many times have I heard things like, you know, an indication that someone has been smoking marijuana is that their teeth and their tongue turns green.
Right, green tongue.
The old green tongue syndrome. And you know, scientifically speaking, that's absolutely just not true. But, you know, it's something that works its way into the police lore. And I don't know how it gets there, but sometimes it's based on, and you know, to be fair to police officers, they're not scientists. They're not necessarily experts on everything. And granted, in this part of the state, we just don't see that much gang stuff. So maybe, you know, the novelty of the potential that it could be something like that was something that just became emotionally overwhelming.
Right, and if they took a silly picture, I presume that the photographer who took the picture
had a choice of which one.
had a choice of which one to use. And I don't blame him, by the way, because I don't think he did anything wrong. He chose a picture. He decided to do this. But for the school district to investigate this as if it's some kind of crime, you're making it far worse. Why not just use a little bit of common sense and go ask the boys and say, you know what? What did you mean by that? Was that something? Clearly, this is a case of the district not understanding this, you know, whatever it is, you know, the three-point sign or whatever it is that was put up. They don't understand it. Why not just go ask them and then they can explain it? And if they explain it, then fine. Then you let them go on because they didn't mean anything by it. They were imitating LeBron James when, in fact, what you rather would do is call the police department. Talk about a waste of resources.
Yeah.
Call the police department, who probably have far better things to investigate than a silly picture. and then have them investigate and confirm that these gestures were gang symbols. And now we need to suspend these boys for this games because we're going to teach them not to show that three-point symbol anymore. We need to teach them.
Boy, and this that does, very, does a lot of good important. Pulling them out of a game where they could have, you know, helped support their school. They could have continued to advance their scholarly pursuits and not have been the subject of this embarrassment, which it's turning into almost universally a you know, making Sheboygan Falls look ridiculous. I mean, that's how it's being portrayed in other news sources.
Yes.
That's how Milwaukee is looking at this, how they're reporting it in the Madison news that I saw on this issue. Like Sheboygan Falls is just some sort of backwards place or something. And that's embarrassing, okay?
Sheboygan Falls, you know, it's not a backwards place. It's just that
it's being portrayed.
It's being portrayed that way. And you know what? This is a bad reflection. This is a really bad reflection on the Sheboygan Falls school district to have this type of outrage over this. And I'm not blaming, by the way, the citizens of Sheboygan Falls who, as you point out, by and large, really don't care about this kind of thing.
Right. Now, let me turn this around a little bit. And I know I've talked about this issue before in other contexts, but this is a problem that we do have in our society when it relates to predetermined sanctions for what is perceived as a categorical form of misconduct. For example, when a young boy mentions something about bringing a knife to school but doesn't actually do it, you know, they have to look up their policies and procedures and take whatever action is prescribed in the book. And I think we've seen a lot of this. So some of this may not be the actual people in the school district. It may be the rigid formality of the policies that appear to, again, go into that realm of that nasty phrase that you and I don't like,
zero tolerance
policy, and what that means. It means that we shall not consider the specific circumstances of any case, and if there is even an apparent possibility of this being some form of danger to our community or our students, that we're going to take the most extreme action we can. And, you know, again, just to look at the other side of this issue to help explain why this groupthink process occurs.
Is there really another side?
Well, I'm just saying,
in this one,
we do live in a world where almost every day we're seeing some story about somebody getting shot in a theater or shot in a school and some kid going in to shoot their math teacher and then shoot himself. And I'm not saying that it justifies the action. It's just that I think that is the explanation. It's the explanation for why we have these inflexible sorts of policy rules that dictate. And you know what? If you're a school administrator, you're going to be scared. Where are you going to err on the side of caution when every day you see somebody going in and shooting up a school
I understand that point, but I don't think it leads to this conclusion.
I'm just trying to somewhat defend the mindset here in terms of the difficult challenges that school administrators do sometimes face.
Well, what one of the boys said is when you take a three, everyone does this sign. You've probably seen LeBron James or someone do it. I did the three in the picture. My little brother pointed at the camera. There were some parents, apparently, that complained about it looking like gang symbols. Jordan Jackson says he didn't know it could be considered a gang symbol, saying, I had no idea. They told us it meant blood.
Right.
Unbelievable. All right. So we do have to take a break, and we'll be back to talk about one of Kirk's favorite subjects, and that would be Justin Bieber.
Oh, dear.
If I was your boyfriend, I'd never let you go. I could take you places you ain't never been before. Baby, take a chance or you'll never ever know. I got money in my hands that I really like to blow. Swipe, swipe, swipe on you. Chilling by the fire while we eating fondue. I don't know about me, but I know about you. So say hello to falsetto in 3, 2, swipe.
I'd like to be everything you want.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. Justin Bieber, I know your favorite topic. We have to talk about
it. Honestly,
him.
I can't tell you a single song. He's a musician or a singer or something.
Something like that.
I don't even know a single song.
I know. I kid.
I know
Kirk.
He's like that baby-faced teenager.
Kirk's a Beatles fan, as am I.
Right.
So, all right. So there was a, let me just point this out from ABC News. There was a man staying at Justin Bieber's home, and he was arrested on narcotics charges. Now, this stems from an execution of a search warrant. The reason the search warrant was executed is because the neighbor of Justin Bieber apparently complained that the Biebs was tossing eggs
at his
house.
Is that what they call it? The Biebs?
The Biebs, yeah. Or I don't know, whatever you call them.
Tossing eggs.
I'm not going to pretend I know that. But anyway, so he's tossing eggs allegedly at this house. It causes approximately $20,000 in vandalism damage.
Yeah, I heard that, and I had to wonder how exactly
that seems a little
any
high.
Egg could, or no matter how many eggs you use, how could that cause $20,000 worth of damage?
I don't know.
Is it emotional damage that
it's emotional
claiming?
Distress? Yes.
Oh my gosh! Look at the eggs on my door. Oh no!
So it causes this damage. Apparently causes this damage. Police execute a search warrant
looking for eggs.
Did they go into the refrigerator? What do you think they did? So they go into this house. They apparently storm this house. There's 11 squads outside of the Biebs house.
And they did like they do on South Park. Like,
it's unbelievable.
Looking for eggs.
So they go in.
Show us where
your
eggs are.
And this is, to be fair, I guess this is a felony because it exceeds $400 in potential damage.
According to the homeowner. Well, isn't it like Beverly Hills or something
like
that?
Yeah, it's somewhere it's in L.A. County.
And theoretically, if you... you know, if
I mean, that's got to be the biggest crime that's committed in Beverly Hills,
one of them.
But not that there's any other drugs in Beverly Hills. So they go to this home and they go inside and they find in plain view what they believe originally to be cocaine. Turns out now they believe it's either Xanax or ecstasy. One of the two. They're not sure which one.
We'll just
but
take
Xanax
your pick.
Or ecstasy. So and they find it on. You could make this stuff up. A house guest. And we know about these house guest laws. Kirk and I won't bore you with them, but and his name is Lil Za.
Lil
and I'm
Za?
Wondering, is that like pizza?
Pizza,
like Lil Za,
like a little pizza.
Yeah, but yeah. Lil Za is the guy's name. They find it on him, or apparently in plain sight near him, and they arrest Lil Za, but they don't arrest the
Biebs.
I don't know if that means they didn't find any eggs, or they're still doing an investigation, or what it is. But you know, he hasn't been arrested nor exonerated for the felony vandalism charges, at least last time I checked.
Last time you checked?
Which was on Thursday.
That could have changed in the interim.
Right. So the point is, this presents all kinds of interesting issues, which is, what can police officers do when they enter a home?
And why did they have 11 squads there
and
to search
why did
for
they
eggs?
Have, exactly. Yeah. Why did they have 11?
And if 11? They did find eggs, how is that proof that he... What sort of evidence are they going to find inside the house of the Biebs? Is that what you said?
The Biebs, yeah.
Justin Bieber.
Right.
What kind of evidence are they going to find that he... Is there going to be like a journal entry? Like, today I threw eggs at my neighbor's house. Or maybe photographs of him, you know, throwing the eggs. Or,
well, there was some cell phone video. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that. But or were they going to do a DNA, comparison tests for the types of eggs? And I mean, how did they get a search warrant to begin with?
I don't know. That's a good question. Well, they might have asked him, can you make us an omelet? And if he said no, well, then they'd be like, aha, we have you.
Because you're out of eggs.
Out of eggs. Because the Biebs loves eggs.
All your
eggs
have been expended in the process of
all you have is bacon.
In vandalism.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it is. They wanted to enter the home and say, please make us an omelet. And then just see what his answer was.
What did you find as a result of this?
In the meantime, they arrested the little Za.
They arrested little Za for what they believed to be cocaine, but it turned out to be either ecstasy or Xanax. They're not sure, or at least last time I checked.
Yeah.
So now
figure that out.
Yeah. So what exactly is going on here? And do they actually have the right? Did they have the right to search this guy? Now, they're saying they found it in plain sight. But what if it had been, Kirk, for example, that he had it on his person, in his pockets or something like that, right?
Well, sure.
Then what?
Well, okay, when the police are executing a search warrant, they do have the constitutional right. I'm not going to say the right to, but it's constitutionally authorized for them to do pat-downs for officer safety, meaning they can check for weapons or, bombs, dynamite, whatever a person has it strapped to their chest, to see if they're going to secure the situation, engage in the activity which they're authorized to do by the warrant, and search for evidence in a peaceful manner. They're entitled to restrain the subjects that are found there on the scene and at least do a pat-down search to search for weapons. Now, what happens is, when they feel a small baggie of something in someone's pocket, they usually say, what's this in your pocket? And then the person says, oh, that's just my cocaine, ecstasy, or Xanax. You pick one. And then
they say,
well, would you mind taking it out of your pocket so that I can see some evidence of wrongdoing on your part? And then the person invariably says, well, yes, sure, I absolutely will. And then it goes from there. So,
okay. Well, and by the way, I just want to let you know, Justin Bieber has a very nice house.
And I saw that.
It appears that they actually had, like, I don't know if they had a chopper cam on, you know, I don't know what they had.
Well,
on a helicopter.
I think there's a helicopter constantly 24 hours a day flying over Beverly Hills. You know,
it's, okay, so maybe then they go to the chopper and they find it. So they actually have the cell phone video, and it just kind of brought me back to, you know, thinking about, you know, my high school days and things like that. What about when people toilet papered somebody else's home? Couldn't you make the argument that if you toilet paper enough,
it's $20,000 damage?
Well, it could cause over $400 in damage,
certainly,
right?
Yeah.
By cleanup and things like that. So then if somebody TPs, it just came to mind that if you knew who was TPing, you could go and then raid their home.
Look for the same kind of toilet paper.
Look for the same type of toilet paper and go into the bathroom and say, aha, you have the Brawny or whatever. Charmin Ultra Soft. You must be, in fact, doing this.
Remember, there was something, I've never done this.
I know.
I just want to make sure that you
understand.
Hypothetically, and I honestly wouldn't do this because it's just, in my mind, it's horrible. You remember sporking or people doing that to people's lawns?
Oh, putting forks in somebody's lawn?
Yeah, the plastic
forks. I don't know
what
you're talking about.
And then, you know, when you try and take them out, they break off and they get stuck. And
I've never heard of that before.
Then it's, I've heard of it, yes.
I have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be.
But that's a tradition. TPing people's houses is a tradition. A high school tradition. Don't they do that when high school students are graduating?
All the
time. And yeah, you know, I've driven all around and I've seen these trees littered with these kinds of things.
Yes.
And it's almost like a celebration.
Is this an example? You know, I guess it could be an example if somebody was egging the Beeb's house,
yeah,
and they went and executed a search warrant on the other person's house, like the not famous person's house.
Yeah,
that you could make the argument maybe that was an example of, you know, celebrity bias or bias in favor of a celebrity, and that's why you're going.
Well, that's
to
what
great
they're
length.
Saying. That if it wasn't Justin Bieber, why
they wouldn't
would,
have
would
done
they have 11 squads there in this whole thing? And I'm not sure what it is exactly about Justin Bieber that they were so afraid of, but
right.
You know, maybe it was just that everybody wanted to be part of the process. They're like, hey, guess what?
We're going to
raid. Anybody want to come? And they're like, I'm going.
Yeah, you know what? Second that, I'd probably go. I'd probably be
just to be part of it? A story you could tell someday?
Right, just
I
to
was
see
there.
The house. I mean, that would be kind of...
to go inside.
Right. I'm not saying it's correct that they rated it. I'm just saying it's...
You could wait for an episode of Cribs to air what the Beeb's house looks like, or you could just be part of this SWAT team that goes in and takes down the egg launcher.
Right. You know? But then they find, like, little Zod. You know, it kind of reminds me of what's going on inside of Charlie Sheen's house, except for much worse. I mean, Charlie had apparently a lot of drugs in his house.
Yeah, but wouldn't he, like,
he had the
shout out the window that he was on drugs and, like,
yes.
and call the police and say he was on drugs? And
right. He had those adult film stars that he called the mystery, or the whatever, the angels, the mystery, Charlie's angels, whatever they were. You know, I don't exactly remember what it was, but there's some odd stuff going on in some of these celebrity homes, and I don't exactly know what's going on.
Well, you know, in terms of, I just have one quick thing that I'd like to mention.
Yes.
That's, you mentioned Lil Za, and it made me think of this story that came about recently.
I'm very hungry.
Only in the sense that it involves the smuggling of red pepper powder and jelly donuts. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't. I'd like to.
Somebody earlier this week, a Madison criminal defense attorney, by the way, was arrested for illegally passing contraband items to somebody in the Portage County Jail. And what happened was, I think it was actually a prison that's in that area. But he went to visit a client of his and brought with him two toothbrushes, a container of red pepper powder. That's where I thought of the pizza thing.
Now I'm hungry.
And jelly donuts to an inmate and passed them on to him, which, if you didn't know this already, and you know that people are not supposed to bring stuff into you because that's
right.
one of the jail rules. Well, either this lawyer didn't know that, or he did know it and thought he was being kind, or I don't know. I don't know that there were any files or any sort of guns or anything baked into the jelly donuts, as far as I can tell. But you know, I'm sure he thought that, hey, you know, the guy probably said, hey, can you bring me two toothbrushes, some red pepper powder, to spice up my my bologna sandwich, and some jelly donuts? I really miss those things. And this was at the Columbia Correctional Center, so I should point that out. It got reported immediately, and this attorney was brought into custody and booked on felony charges of delivery of articles to an inmate. So he is pending charges.
For the jelly donut and the chili powder.
Yes, for bringing unauthorized items into and conveying them to an inmate. against the jail rules.
Well, listen.
I know that we're all presumed to know those rules, but I don't think it was an evil intent by any means. It's hard to say exactly.
Felony charge is pretty rough.
Seems pretty rough.
That's very rough. Yeah. Well, Kirk, we have to talk about one other topic this morning, and we'll talk about a Madison man who was facing deportation for small amounts of marijuana that he had years and years ago. We'll talk about that and much more when we get back. Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. Kirk, I found this story, and this was Alexander Timofeev. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. If I'm mistaken, I apologize. But he was facing deportation from this country back to Russia. At the time that he actually came over to this country, he was a boy, you know. He was not yet an adult, and he came from the then Soviet Union over to the United States and settled in the Madison area. Well, he was arrested over 1 year ago by ICE, and he was told that he would be...
You mean Ice-T?
Yes, Ice-T.
You mean like Law and Order?
No, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Oh, okay.
That would
all
be
right.
It.
All right. Okay.
And he was told that he would be deported because of his marijuana possession convictions from years ago, including in 1996, all right? He was 14 years old in 1992 when he moved here, or moved to the state with his family from the former Soviet Union. He was then fighting to get his old convictions vacated because he was in his 20s when many of these occurred, and his brain was essentially not fully developed. He had reformed himself. He had completed his sentences. He was actually charged, I believe, with a felony, at least for a second offense. And so he worked up until this point at the Nakoma Country Club in the Madison area as a chef. He has kids. His family is in this area. He has nobody else left in the Soviet Union, or now Russia. Now they're going back to the 80s here, but in what is now Russia. And, you know, he was going to be deported back there. And there really was no discretion at that point if they considered this to be a deportable offense. And so in 1996, there was actually a law that took away discretion from immigration judges. Now, you and I are not immigration attorneys, and we always recommend people go see them if they have immigration issues. But it was a law that basically took away discretion in these types of offenses from immigration judges. And so Mr. Timofey moved to have his convictions vacated because his attorneys at the time, apparently, according to him, did not advise him of the potential consequences of being deported. And originally, the Dane County Circuit Judge, Ellen Burrs, agreed to vacate these convictions. And there was a complicated appeal process that went over. The point of the story is it came back down, and she ended up vacating his conviction. So the ending of the story is a happy one for Mr. Timofey, even that he gets to stay here, at least for the foreseeable future. The whole point of this story, what actually initiated this, is there was an ICE agent who came to Mr. Timofey's home over a year ago. He thought that she was delivering some good news about his immigration status, because I think he had applied. I don't know if it was for permanent residency or what it was, but he had applied. He thought it was good. He ended up being taken into custody, or at least being told, if not taken into custody, that he was going to be deported. And this brings to mind a question, because this is one of those rules that goes back to, well, should we really be having this strict rule for a marijuana conviction of somebody years and years ago, over a decade ago, who got these convictions and now he's going to be removed? By the way, he's paying taxes. He uses his real name. He does everything by the book. He's got a job. He's a contributing member to society. And yet we're going to ship him back to Russia. Does that just seem right? You know, the law aside, does that seem like the right thing?
Well, I think the problem is when you remove discretion from the agency that's responsible for implementing those laws. And we see this all over the place. We see efforts to limit that type of decision-making authority and to not be able to take into consideration the specifics of any given case. Federal law in particular is extremely inflexible in that regard. We see cases where, I mean, even a run-of-the-mill federal case where somebody's facing a conviction that, you know, we have to deal with sentencing guidelines, which, although they're not mandatory, they used to be up until a few years ago, 2005, the court was bound by the sentencing guidelines. guidelines and had to impose sentences that included, it operated as though there were a mandatory minimum because the court couldn't deviate from that guideline range. There are other federal laws, and there are more federal laws that have mandatory minimums than there are state laws that have those types of minimums. And it has the effect of basically removing the individual characteristics of any particular case from the actual case itself and treating somebody as a number or a file or a piece of paper that happens to have a stamp of violation of this particular type of law. You know what makes things worse is that people within the quote-unquote executive branch of government, which includes prosecutors that are implementing or executing the laws that are part of our process, they are tasked with making sure that they carry out what appears to be the legislative intent. And when the legislature says, we're going to have a mandatory action in response to somebody who fits in that particular category, as in this case, if the rule says that the nature of the conviction is such that it becomes a deportable offense, and since 1996, we have removed any discretion from an administrative judge or an immigration judge to do something other than taking action for deportation, well, you know, what we've done here is that we're not only making a nonsensical and illogical advancement of a legislative agenda, which isn't necessarily there, but we're putting the burden on the executive branch to make sure that it remains inflexible. We're telling people, we're telling prosecutors that what is meant by this is that you're supposed to have horse blinds on and that you're supposed to treat everybody the same way, in a harsh way, because right. That's what the legislature wanted to do. Now, you say what you will about whether that's a good idea or not, but what essentially this does that really grinds my gears is that it takes away that third and very important branch of our government, the judiciary,
right?
Or those that, even if in an administrative sense, they're tasked with a judicial-like function.
To use discretion.
And that's what judges are for, to make sure that these kinds of things don't happen. I think that there's a very good argument that needs to be more developed, that things that remove discretion completely from what we call an Article 3 judge. Article 3 means under Article 3 of the Constitution. Article 3 is that which establishes the judicial branch of government as a balance of powers. There's an equal distribution of powers, and through the use of checks and balances, we're supposed to have a way in which the legislature or the executive branch, or for that matter, the judicial branch, doesn't have an undue amount of power over the others.
Right.
So, interesting that we have this type of phenomenon.
There was a case, actually, that was recently on this. The U.S. Supreme Court took up a case and decided a case where they essentially held that a social sharing of a small amount of marijuana by immigrants who are lawfully in the U.S. does not require automatic deportation. There was a Jamaican citizen in the year 2007 who was stopped with 1.3 grams of pot, not a lot. He then pleaded guilty to possession with intent, which is sort of surprising, right. A felony. And they called that an aggravated felony and sought to deport him. And so this is the problem. This is considered to be an aggravated felony. And so when it comes to this, you know, deportable offenses, we like to think of this and we like to think of, okay, make this blanket rule that if you have any felony, just right. Pick a felony, we ought to deport you because you've committed a serious crime.
Well, right. And the idea is that if you're going to be a guest in our country, you got to behave yourself. And if you don't, we've got the discretion, the freedom to get rid of you. It's not really discretion, though,
right.
Is it? And you know, it's interesting because there's two simultaneous phenomena that are occurring here. On the one hand, we have the laws that are there to treat offenses categorically, again, as aggravated, as an aggravated type felony. And unfortunately, that comes down to the fact that if a prosecutor can charge a case that falls within, you know, a possession with intent. Now, you mentioned that before, and you said it's odd to figure how somebody with 1.3 grams. But let me just point this out,
okay.
Casey. Let me finish my point here, if you let me finish.
Ahead and finish.
Would you please
point.
Let me finish?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now I forgot what I was going to say. No, actually, I do remember what I was going to say. We have this competing tension where prosecutors are tasked with this, you know, charge what you can. And if the person says something dumb, like, I was going to share this joint with my friend, you know, well, technically, that does constitute possession with intent. Because on the one hand, we put things in that category of aggravated felonies for a supposedly good reason. But on the other hand, the reverse side of that coin is that the definition of intent is so broadly defined that it includes activity all the way at the extreme end of somebody that is a drug dealer that's moving pounds and pounds and pounds of pot through state lines and across international borders, all the way to the Jamaican guy that's got a spliff that he's going to share with somebody while they're playing their kettle drums or something. I don't know. I mean, it goes all those things are considered possession with intent.
Right.
All of them.
Right.
The entire spectrum.
Well, and let me just, and that's a good point, but getting back to the issue as to how did the defendant himself convince the prosecutors, after having this case, the convictions vacated, not to recharge him? And you know how they did it? They actually talked to him not only about his record, which I give the prosecutors credit for considering this, not only his lack of a record since that time, essentially, but also his good behavior, the fact that he pays taxes, the fact that he is a contributing member of society, that he doesn't, you know, use an alias. And they actually brought in a UW neurologist who talked about how brains in their 20s, although we treat them as adults, are not fully developed, and people in their 20s, I think common sense dictates this, are more likely to engage in high-risk, thrill-seeking behavior. And that the fact that he got these three possession of marijuana convictions is completely consistent with the fact that when he was younger, he was engaging in that type of behavior because his brain was not fully developed. Now, you might call that hogwash or say, oh, that's just an excuse making. But the fact of the matter is they were able to back it up with scientific evidence. All right. Well, we do have to go. That's all the time we have for the show today. This has been Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you next week.